6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted.
And good afternoon. You're listening to A Public Affair. My name is Norman Stockwell. I am your host today. And today we are going to be discussing We Are Wisconsin, the book. But before we get started, to let you know, this is Labor Day. This is a Labor Day edition of A Public Affair.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if you come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. Today the policeman's a union man, brother firefighter's my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. That's why my friend the blood tastes good every time I'm here. I got a will to win and a Cheshire grin. Yeah, the night watchman is near. And you can't get it where you're at, but you can sure get it here. So come rain or sleet or dark at night, come wind or frigid snow, there's 100,000 in the streets, and that number's gonna grow. And when we put the governor on trial, I'll be in the front row. Just take a look around, we're a union town. 1, 2, 3, 4, let's go. This is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line.
And that is Tom Morello. And today on A Public Affair, we are going to be discussing a brand new book that's just come out. It's called We Are Wisconsin, the Book. And that is the website for it as well, wearewisconsinthebook.com. And joining me here in the studio is Dan Wong, who's one of the contributors to the book. We're also trying to get a couple other folks on the line, but we're having a little trouble with the connection right now. But I am going to introduce my guest, Dan Wong, first off, who is an artist and activist and writer and teaches in Chicago as well as living here in Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to Public Affair.
Pleasure to be here, Norm.
Dan, let's start off with you, and if you could talk a little bit about you actually have two contributions to the book, and I want to talk about the first one first. You talk about, I guess, the question of why this happened in Madison, and let's start out by telling people that the this that we're talking about is, of course, the protests that took place starting in February of this year. But let's start from the beginning and talk about your setting of the stage of what Madison, Wisconsin looks like.
Well, my perspective comes from being a relative newcomer to the town. I've lived here for going on 5 years, which, you know, sounds like a long time. But because I've been teaching elsewhere and traveling much of the time, you know, I haven't actually spent that much at that many years in town. So I've always had this sort of perspective of somehow being something of a long-term visitor and observing the city in that through those eyes. And it's the particularities of the city that I was thinking about when these protests emerged. And as this became a sustained movement over those first 2 weeks, I really reflected on why this would happen here as opposed to other places in the way that it did, having to do with things that I talk about in that text in the book, namely the way that policing is handled in the city, the way that there is over the decades, you know, has been built a kind of infrastructure of alternative institutions, all these kinds of things that helped this city become, you know, what I saw as the host of this movement that was really based on, at least in those first few weeks, you know, the mass assemblage of people.
So it's almost like the conditions were right. The soil was fertile, and the protests were able to grow in a way that they might not have been able to grow in another city or another time.
Well, I had you know, friends and people that I knew from out of town come to town because they heard something was going on. They wanted to check it out. Some of them came early on. I ran into a friend from New York who happens to have a cousin here in town who's a labor activist and an art activist out in New York, and you know, rushed over to stay with his cousin just to check out what was happening here in the first weekend. And I ran into him at the Capitol in the rotunda, and he's like, this could never happen in New York. Oh, my God. You know, and that was the kind of a distinctiveness that marked this movement, was that, you know, here we had the conditions ready. And that was, to me, is very interesting.
And we're speaking with Dan Wong, who's here with us in the studio. The book is We Are Wisconsin, The Wisconsin Uprising, in the words of activists, writers, and everyday Wisconsinites who made it happen. And I'm hoping that now we have our conference calling thing worked out, and we should have joining us by phone Erica Sagrins, the editor of this book. Erica, are you with us?
Yep, I'm here.
Great, great. And Mike Elk, labor journalist. Mike, are you with us?
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. And Sarah Van Gelder, who is editor of Yes Magazine and one of the contributors to the book. Sarah, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. So we have everybody joining us by phone through the marvels of technology. And understand that since this is Labor Day, I am laboring here pretty much solo and doing the engineering as well as the hosting of this program. So I apologize to the three of you for the little technical difficulties of getting you on the air. Again, the book is called We Are Wisconsin, The Wisconsin Uprising, in the words of activists, writers, and everyday Wisconsinites who made it happen. It's full of all kinds of stuff, some of it published elsewhere in other books, some of it only ever published here. And Erica Sagrins, you are the editor of this project. You pulled this whole thing together. Talk a little bit about why this book, why now, and how you made it happen.
Sure. Well, first off, thanks so much for having us. It's really great to be here on Labor Day, and thanks for you know, all the great coverage that you guys have been doing. I think for me, you know, I have been working in Democratic politics in D.C. for about 4 years, and I left this winter, you know, after the midterms. I was kind of feeling pretty, you know, not inspired by the state of politics, by the state of, you know, the progressive movement. I just, you know, was sort of trying to figure out what was happening, you know, seeing the Tea Party, seeing kind of that momentum on the other side, but not really feeling like there was much going on, you know, the sort of more progressive side or our side of things. So I sort of did some traveling. I ended up in London and spending time with activists and writers there, you know, that was February, while the Wisconsin protests were happening, and sort of following them from afar and seeing them sort of from that lens of these, you know, other activists who were just so inspired by what was happening, you know, in Madison and across Wisconsin. But at the same time, you know, I was with these London folks who were doing their own organizing. You know, there was 500,000 people marched, you know, in the streets in London in March for one of their really huge anti-cuts protests that they had there. But as we sort of did that organizing and as I was seeing what they were doing, there was this really strong connection with Wisconsin, too. There was, you know, we watched the YouTube video of Tony Schultz speak in front of the Madison Capitol. People were, you know, watching these videos that had been live-streamed on phones come out of the protest. There was just this incredible sense of connection and inspiration kind of between movements. And folks there in London had put together a book called Fight Back, which was about the student protest that they did that happened there this winter, you know, when students really came out and started fighting back against these, you know, tuition hikes and, you know, just all these cuts to education there. So they had put together this collection that I thought was really great and just sort of captured the spirit of their protest. So I came back, when I came back to the States in April, I decided to do something similar with what had happened in Wisconsin. And, you know, I'm not from Wisconsin. It wasn't really something I was involved in during the protest. It wasn't really my fight, but it was something that I felt inspired by and wanted to kind of think of a way to figure out how to continue that that story. And I thought that putting together a book could kind of capture the spirit of what had happened, you know, try and continue the momentum. And I did it in, you know, a pretty quick time frame. I started in April, and it just came out in August because I thought that, you know, I could kind of capture the immediacy and the momentum of the moment. You know, a lot of it, there's sort of a parallel narrative through Twitter. You know, I think a lot of the writing and, you know, the organizing and, you know, happened in these sort of in ways that was communicated on social media, through Twitter, through Facebook and blogs. A lot of it's that, you know, a lot of it's that very immediate energy, but then also combined with some sort of more reflective essays. You know, there's some new introductions, one from Mike, one from myself. There's some new pieces, some new interviews. So it kind of just situates it, and, you know, I think that this can be kind of an opportunity to kind of look back a little bit, but also use it to figure out, you know, what's been happening and where do we go from here, you know, and it's something that we don't have to wait, you know. A lot of books. I didn't meet the traditional publisher, so it came out. I was able to do it a lot faster than I think I would have otherwise.
And the book.
So, that's sort of the overview. But,
The book is about 300 pages. It's right. Full of dozens and dozens of articles by activists and authors and scholars. It includes something by Noam Chomsky, Van Jones, Medea Benjamin, John Nichols, as you mentioned, from here in Madison, has a couple of pieces in there. Some of the articles have appeared previously in publications like Yes Magazine, like The Progressive, like Truth Out, The Nation, of course, The Buffalo Beast with his Scott Walker prank phone call. The other thing the book includes, which I think is great, is a bunch of the Twitter feeds. It includes little snippets from Twitter, 148 character messages that popped up, and of course includes the date when those appeared in the Twitter sphere. It also includes a blog roll, so you can see a bunch of the blogs that have been covering Wisconsin throughout the struggle, and a timeline, which is very useful to Those of us that are thinking back now and trying to remember, now, was that the second weekend or was that the third weekend? I can't remember. I also have on the phone with us labor journalist Mike Elk, who is joining us by phone from D.C. And Mike writes the foreword here and also has another article in the book. And, Mike, you actually got up off of your sick bed and flew out to Madison beating an ice storm in order to get here to cover the protests in Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, it was it was about a few days after everybody was out there. And I had, you know, I'm a labor reporter, so I cover labor struggles around the country. And the winter was a particularly dark one for me. I've been struggling with pneumonia, and I was actually just broken up with my ex-girlfriend, and it seemed like everything in the world was going wrong. There was all these attacks on organized labor. And I was at home, somewhat still struggling with pneumonia, pretty tired most of the time. And I got up off my sickbed, and you know, I came out to Wisconsin, and I, you know, I'll never forget it. I arrived there in an ice storm, and the first thing I did was I went to John Nichols and Mary Bottier's house. And I remember John being such a nice guy that he let me borrow his car to go drive down to the Capitol, and you know, it's something I'll never forget. Quite being around labor all of my life and knowing that no matter what happened, that we had made a stand here in Wisconsin, that people were not going to forget organized labor, that it was just not going to slit its own wrist, which is what happens in so many of these situations. I mean, there was a lot of deal-making going on, different unions willing to trade public unions down the river in different situations, and this was a situation where we all stood up and said no. And so I think for that, you know, there was a dynamic there. There was something, a new confidence, a new inspiration that came out of Wisconsin. And I see it all the time when I go around the country. You know, when I'm covering union rallies, it doesn't matter if I'm in rural Kentucky or Massachusetts or wherever, somebody shows up with the Wisconsin Solidarity Fist on a T-shirt, and they, you know, they're always showing it off. And it left a rallying cry in people. There's a new confidence that I think wasn't there before, and I think we're starting to see around the country this kind of building of support, this building of militancy, of confidence that we didn't see before.
You know, Mike, one of the things you say in your piece is that the media narratives coming out of Wisconsin were about how it had changed the politics of union busting and shifted public opinion. But Madison did more than that. It revived the concept of street protests, strikes, and solidarity actions. You talk later in the book about sort of only two actions, really, since the election of President Obama. You cite the Madison protests and the takeover of the factory at Republic Windows and Doors in Chicago. What is special about those two actions?
I mean, so those two actions were actions that were they created a situation of tension, right? You're occupying a place. You're preventing the normal functioning of society, which, you know, you can argue the Wisconsin State Capitol occupation certainly did. You know, you're preventing the normal functioning of society. You're creating a tension, and you're creating a situation people are forced to negotiate. And people forget that Scott Walker was negotiating with senators before he decided to illegally cast the bill. So you're creating a situation of tension. And you're getting in these situations where you're having very bold, very long, very sustained protests. We're just not talking day or two long protests. You're getting people on board with it, and you're drawing a lot of public support. And those have been the two biggest ones. I mean, and if you look at, you know, I think the problem that we have in the labor movement is we go out on a one-day rally, we all give speeches, and we expect that to be enough. And that's not. I mean, you really have to sustain a fight for a very long time. I mean, you have to break the will of the employer to resist, create a situation where they cannot put up with it anymore. And those were the two, and also rally public support, and those were the two situations where I think they've really been able to do it. Now, as for the issue of how it's changed politics, I think too much in the labor movement, we focused on the electoral box as the way to change politics. And you can change politics outside of the electoral box. I mean, let's look at the Great Depression. During the Great Depression, you had a mass wave of sit-in strikes. In 1935, you had 537 sit-in strikes alone. In, you know, the civil rights movement, you had huge cities that were being shut down. You had huge situations of tension where elected leaders, even Republican ones, were forced to negotiate because they simply could not put up with the pressure anymore. So I think Madison brought back in that spirit. And I think since Madison, I've seen a number of dramatic things happen that hadn't been happening before. For instance, you had some illegal construction strikes a few weeks ago in New York City. You had about 100 longshoremen occupy a non-union port in Longview, Washington. You had a sit-in strike at a Hershey plant in central Pennsylvania. And, you know, a lot of the common threads we're seeing run through this is that, you know, Wisconsin woke people up. It's no longer the era of making deals and hoping that you can get a good deal as opposed to a bad deal. It's an era of saying, look, this is where things stop. The buck stops here. And I really think that's what Wisconsin achieved.
We are talking about the brand new book, which is called We Are Wisconsin, The Wisconsin Uprising in the Words of Activists, Writers, and Everyday Wisconsinites Who Made It Happen. It includes Senator Kathleen Vinehout, who was one of the 14 who left. It includes activists from the Teaching Assistants Association like Alex Hanna. It includes many nationally known figures as well as local activists here. Also writing in the book is Sarah Van Gelder.
Hey, yes. Can I just let folks know, too, about the website and how to find the book?
Please do. I was going to do that in just a second, but go right ahead.
Okay.
The website for the book is wearewisconsinthebook.com. Is that correct?
It's wearewisconsinbook.com, yep. And it's also just there. I just wanted to let people know, too, that it's a free PDF you can download there, as well as ordering a copy. And it's also going to be at Rainbow Bookstore in Madison pretty shortly.
Great. And the book is available, as you say, for purchase as a printed book, but you also have the marvelous ability to download it as a PDF, which means you can download it not only onto your computer, but you can download it onto your phone, which I did and had a chance to read it over the weekend as I was traveling in Minnesota. So the book We Are Wisconsin is just out, and it's available in local bookstores as it rolls out of the shipping crates. I was going to move on to Sarah Van Gelder, who's also joining us from Washington State. Sarah is the co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine. And Sarah, you had a piece in the book that was based on something you wrote in Yes Magazine very early on in the struggle about the possibility of Wisconsin as the first stop in an American uprising. And that sort of takes off from some of what Mike was just saying.
Yeah, that's right. I think what I was looking at from the vantage point of Seattle is, you know, are other people picking up on this idea? It seemed like a timing, you know, following after some of the early successes of the Arab Spring, that there might have been some inspiration coming from that direction, but there's certainly inspiration coming from Wisconsin. And the example I cited was the U.S. Uncut movement that was actually started, inspired by the U.K. Uncut movement. And basically, if your listeners haven't heard about that, it's basically the notion that, you know, if the big corporate forces in our society who are continuing to make huge profits, if they paid their fair share of the taxes, all these austerity cuts of the kinds we're seeing coming out of Madison would not be necessary because we wouldn't, in fact, be broke, as Michael Moore said so famously. We aren't broke. We're still a very wealthy country. And if people pay their fair share of the taxes, we actually have enough money to do what we need to do and to not be asking the people who've already sacrificed so much to sacrifice even more. So that was a story I wrote in Yes Online, not Yes Magazine, yesmagazine.org. But the other thing that was in your book in the Made We Are Wisconsin was a piece by Van Jones that was looking at another spinoff effect, and I think perhaps a more important and long-lived one, which is this new movement to rebuild the American dream. You may have heard about this. This is involving Van Jones and Move On and the Center for Community Change. A lot of folks, you know, union, community, all sorts of people who are saying, you know, we are tired of seeing the middle class take the brunt of all these economic woes. It wasn't the middle class that got us into this situation. And, the you know, to ask the middle class and the poor of this country to do all the sacrificing just isn't right. And these folks are developing a whole contract for rebuilding the American dream. It's a wonderful progressive contract. They've had house meetings all over the United States. They've had, I believe, more than 1,000 house meetings through the Move On Network and others. And folks worked together to develop this contract of 10 items for rebuilding the American dream so that it can benefit everyone and it isn't, you know, this continued move towards benefiting the very wealthy at the expense of everyone else.
And we're talking about the brand new book, We Are Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Uprising, in the words of activists, writers, and everyday Wisconsinites who made it happen. You can get it online at wearewisconsinbook.com. You can get it in local bookstores as it comes out of the shipping crates. And this really is just brand new out. The grand opening event for the book was just about a week ago. It includes articles by many names that will be familiar to WART listeners, including Elizabeth DiNovella, Alex Hanna, Senator Kathleen Vinehout, and my guests here in the studio and on the phone, Dan Wong and Mike Elk and Sarah Van Gelder and editor Erica Sagrins. The piece, Dan, that you had, the second piece that you had in the book, which you wrote together with Nicholas Lampert, kind of talks about some of the lost moments in this Wisconsin movement too. And I think that's important because the book is not just about the possibilities and hopes, but also some of the lessons learned. Talk a little bit about the lost moment, the lost strike moment in this Wisconsin uprising.
Well, we're talking about March 9th. March 9th was the evening of March 9th is the moment when Scott Walker, when in the days before that, he'd kind of, you know, sent out his sort of decoy messages of negotiating this and that, but then pulled that surprise move with the Walker, with the Fitzgeralds in ramming through the provision of the bill that addresses the collective bargaining. So that took the movement by surprise, and to me and to Nicholas, my co-author for that piece, that was sort of the crucial moment in which our movement did not take that next step in escalation. Up until then, it had been this kind of very interesting and to that moment successful tit-for-tat kind of escalation where, you know, they would do one thing or try to do something, we would do another and raise the stakes and force them to recalculate their next move, right? In my mind and in my memory, it counts as a lost moment because the stage was perfectly set. It was a Wednesday night, and if there had been a one-day strike called for the next day, and if you go back to the Twitter feeds from that night, oh my gosh, you know, that's what it was all about. That was general strike. You know, that was the anger was there, the emotion was there, and okay, so a one-day strike on Thursday, and basically calling Walker's bluff about what are you going to do? Are you going to fire people for a one-day strike? Okay, probably not. Does he really have the courage to do something like that? Well, if he doesn't by the end of Thursday, then you say, well, we're going to strike Friday too, right? And then there's already a huge demonstration called for that Saturday, and if there had been a strike going on, could you have imagined the kind of mood and energy on that day? And who knows what would have happened? That was the whole thing, was like keeping it unpredictable, which the movement had been very good at doing with a kind of collective intelligence coming from all different constituencies at all different times in all different stages up until that moment. So that to me was kind of like an interesting lesson in terms of a graspable moment that somehow could not be realized.
Now, I did talk to one journalist who was saying that he hoped that the history books would reflect that the sick out of the Madison teachers was, in fact, a general strike of a sort, that the teachers all walking out of the schools or sicking out of the schools beginning that week of the first Capitol occupation and staying through the following Monday, I think it was really in many ways kind of a general strike moment, because not only were the teachers not in the schools, but that meant that the parents of the kids who weren't in the schools were also in many cases staying home, and all the kids, of course, were up at the Capitol.
That's right. I mean, it had happened already in that first week. And that's what, when we think about a general strike or any kind of, you know, strike across sectors, that's, I think, is what was interesting about the Wisconsin uprising, was that it could have come from any one constituency. It could have been the unions or any particular union. It could have been students. It could have been the TAA saying, hey, we're going to strike that next day. And then that might have started a chain kind of solidarity actions. Mm-hmm. And that's really how it would have to start, I think.
Mike Elk, you talk about this, the teachers going out, and also the high school students, even in Stoughton, a small community just south of Madison, and how that inspired a lot of actions, and yet also the concerns of sort of the bureaucracy in place and how that kind of prevented some actions from going further.
Yeah, you know, my colleague John Nichols said that the reason why Madison was so successful was because it happened so quickly that labor leaders did not have time to develop their talking points. So instead, people showed up to rally under the banner of an injury to one is an injury to all, and that folks, it became very improvisational, it became very quick, it became very spontaneous, and the people leading the actions were in control. Now, if we look at the labor movement since then, they have really fumbled the momentum in the largest ways. If you look at Richard Trumka, the national leader of the AFL-CIO, we've seen a total lack of leadership. Let me give you a good example. During General Electric, one of the most politically toxic companies in the United States, because they don't pay any taxes, there was a lot of uproar, was negotiating a contract with 15,000 union workers spread out among 80 factories in the U.S. The union wanted to resist concessions, and they were in a very difficult position to strike. And what they needed in order to do this was Trumka to really come out and hit General Electric. Now, hitting General Electric is difficult because the CEO of General Electric, Jeffrey Immelt, is the president's chair of the Jobs Commission, which is kind of ironic considering GE has shipped 32 factories overseas since Obama's come into office. But he's the Jobs Commission chairman. So there was a meeting of the Jobs Commission chair in Raleigh, North Carolina. And several union leaders went to Trumka and said, don't go to the meeting. Protest this meeting. And Trumka refused. He refused to protest the president for meeting with a man who was asking for concessions while making huge profits and paying no taxes. We've seen this in a number of other situations where labor has lost momentum. We see this right now on the issue of the tar sands pipeline, something that would be devastating to communities around the world and cost jobs if we put through this pipeline to bring down oil from the tar sands region of Alberta. And we've seen labor, a couple unions, because they're going to secure 6,000 union jobs, support the project. While other unions, such as the Amalgamated Transit Union and the Transport Workers Union, have come out against it. Now, we've seen mass protests of environmentalists over the last 2 weeks in front of the White House. Over 1,000 people have been arrested protesting this pipeline. This is an opportunity to take that flame that we started in Wisconsin and move the fire of environmentalists a bit closer, make that flame stronger. But instead, we're losing our allies. So if you look at it, labor, especially labor leadership, has returned to business as usual. And I'm really critical of what Sarah Van Gelder said. I've really looked at this thing, this Rebuild the American Dream movement that Van Jones is starting, and it's a bunch of crap. I mean, the people funding it and leading it are the same people that didn't have the courage to stand up in the early days and denounce this president when he gave zero speeches on labor law reform. So I highly, highly doubt anything's going to come out of that. What's really going to happen is that folks on their own individually that saw Wisconsin, and I see this on picket lines, are going to get a sense of some sense of confidence and have something to happen. Stephen Lerner, one of the architects of Justice for Janitors, told me, that if the labor movement is big enough that we can control it, it's too small to matter. And I think at this point, the biggest obstacle we have is labor leaders that are hesitant to take on sources of power, that are engaged in deal-making, and not letting people do what happened in Wisconsin.
Sarah?
Sorry, yes, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. I was just wondering, do you want to respond to what Mike was saying? I mean, I think that it's interesting to look at sort of all of the different things that are being inspired by Wisconsin, but also perhaps by Cairo and by London and by Tunisia. What about some of these different movements, and what are their possibilities, but also what are their shortcomings?
Well, I think to answer that, you have to go back to that amazing presidential campaign that brought Barack Obama into office. And what you saw there was an extraordinary community organizing effort that involved young people becoming protagonists, using their own language, not talking points from the Democratic Party, just becoming involved and becoming leaders in an extraordinary way. And then this entire movement was essentially turned over to the Democratic National Committee to do with as it would. And we all know what happens at that point. It becomes an instrument of the entrenched power structure instead of having the independence that we so badly needed. So all of that organizing, all those lists of millions of people, all of that, you know, that sort of hope and change inspiration just got subsumed under the Democratic power structure. And you know, people because they had, you know, because the people who were involved had so much hope in the president, they were all willing to give him a lot of room to, you know, see what he could do with this, you know, an extraordinary moment. And of course, there's been a lot of disappointment coming from the Obama administration because of the way that he did things, like marginalized the single payer advocates and anybody who was really looking for really profound change. They tended to get marginalized. They literally were not allowed at the table when the discussion of the health care reform was going on. Obama ended up trying to hold the left, if you will. It was actually the middle. But because he'd marginalized anybody to the left of him, he became the left, and he just kept compromising and compromising towards the right. So that is background. You know, I think some of the people that are involved now in this movement to rebuild the American dream are now realizing that we have to have independent political movements if we're going to get anything out of any president, regardless of how much or little he actually believes in the progressive values he espouses. We absolutely have to have independent political movements. And this movement, I think, is an attempt to build such a thing. It actually has some parallels to the Tea Party. The Tea Party also has seen that they can't just let themselves be subsumed under the Republican Party. They've remained independent and yet been an enormous force for shifting the dialogue and shifting the policies of the Republican Party. And on the left, we need something that can likewise be independent of the Democratic Party, but can say, you know, if you do the things that we the people want, and actually, you know, polls show a majority of people want in many cases, if you will do those things, fine, we'll work for your campaigns and we'll get you elected. We'll all be part of it. If you fail to do that, we are going to run people against you in the primaries. You know, we're going to hold this up as a litmus test. And one of the best examples, I think, of that right now, that's sort of following up on that great energy out of Wisconsin, is the nurses' union out of California and now spreading nationally. They're saying, you know, they're drawing a line in the sand when it comes to financial transaction tax. They're saying we need to have a tax on all of that Wall Street buying and selling, a small tax on that, and we will no longer be a country that's broke. We will have the money to do the things we need to do, including to provide health care for people. And they're willing to go to the mat for that. They're becoming quite a militant union. And it's so refreshing now to see these, you know, particularly women who are really paying attention to the questions of life and death that they confront every day when they help people out who are without medical insurance or who are worried about their medical insurance. These are the women who are on the front line of this debate, and they have become so militant in their absolute insistence that the wealthy in this country who are getting off scot-free need to start paying their share.
I
don't agree with that. I don't think sending out a press release is militancy or talking about it all the time. When you start having hundreds of nurses arrested on Wall Street, then you have militancy. I mean, I talked with Dan Choi, who was the leader of the gay rights movement, and the key is just not an issue of political independence. I was in D.C. when this was happening, and there were plenty of people standing up. There were plenty of people standing up in blogosphere. The key is you have to create a situation of tension in which people negotiate. And you can't do that unless you do what you did in the 30s and the 60s and have people laying down in front of the railroad tracks, occupying state capitals, occupying banks, occupying foreclosed homes. And you're not going to do this with this simple feel-good, let's all release a press release and have a one-day summit. I mean, that's just not going to work. And I don't think the National Nurses Union is doing any seriously politically militant. I mean, sure, saying...
I'm talking about the California...
But look at what the gay rights movement did. Look at what the gay rights movement did. The gay rights movement is the model for how the rest of the political movement did. Dan Choi saw that the gay rights movements were looking to make a deal, and he said no. He went to the White House, and he chained himself to the fence several times. Gay rights activists went to every rally the president had, and they heckled him. When I start seeing the National Nurses Union chain themselves to the fence of the White House, when I see them heckling the president the way the gay rights movement does, then we can call that militancy. Until now, it's just press release, you know, buffering around.
Excuse me, I was talking about the California Nurses Association, and they've actually been out on the street holding rallies all over California, insisting first on single-payer health care, and secondly, that it's time for Wall Street to step up and pay their share. It's far more than a press release.
And you're listening.
I would beg to differ.
You're listening to A Public Affair. This is a Labor Day edition of A Public Affair, and we have joining us by telephone labor journalist Mike Elk and Yes Magazine co-founder and executive editor Sarah Van Gelder, along with Erica Sagrins, the editor of the brand new book We Are Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Uprising in the words of activists, writers, and everyday Wisconsinites who made it happen, just out and available online at wearewisconsinbook.com. You can download a PDF of the book and read some of the things that we're talking about here on the program. You can also order it or get it in your local bookstore. Also here with me in the studio, Dan Wong, who is a Madison-based cultural activist and writer and has a couple of pieces in this book. And also taking your phone calls at 256-2001. And we have somebody patiently waiting on the line. I want to get to that caller, but I do just have to throw out one more thing because I can't let, Sarah, your comment about the Tea Party go unaddressed without noting the funding differences, that while the Tea Party may or may not be independent from the Republican Party, they certainly get an awful lot of funding from a lot of billionaire backers, including the Koch brothers, who have also funded the Scott Walker campaign here in the state of Wisconsin. And it was amazing when the Tea Party rallies came to Madison earlier, before the election of Scott Walker, and they talked about it being a spontaneous grassroots movement that just happened to show up with their truck with the Jumbotron TV on the back. So I think that a different program, perhaps, we need to kind of dissect a little bit more the funding issues around the Tea Party and movements on the left and what some of those differences are. But I want to get to our caller who's holding on the line patiently. And hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Norman. I just had a few observations after listening to this discussion. I think a problem among the left is the fact that we tend to take an event in the past and then just keep romanticizing it out of proportion, even though that event did not really change a great deal. I would use certain examples like the Spanish Revolution or the Battle of Seattle, or most recently the occupation of the Capitol. I mean, we'll be talking about those now for years, but without really building upon them. And that's a concern I have. The other concern I have is how the occupation of the Capitol was essentially hijacked by the business unions. For example, in the much-touted recording that the School for Workers put out about this much-touted CD, one has to listen to the head of what I would regard as the most offensive business union in this country, Michael Goodwin of the Office and Professional Employees International Union. Of course, I have personal reasons for being very bitter towards OPEIU, but I just think that the fact that someone like that comes and people listen to him and take him seriously without questioning the kind of union that he represents, I think all this does not bode well. And I suspect that we're just going to be talking about the occupation of the Capitol now for years to come, but I don't really see much that has come out of that. So I'll just take my comments off the air. And thanks for an interesting program, though. Bye.
Okay, thank you very much for that call. And the CD that the caller is referring to was produced by Workers Independent News together with WORT Radio. And it's called This Is What Democracy Sounds Like. And it was produced and distributed again by Workers Independent News. And that website is laborradio.org. I want to toss this over to Dan Wong, who is here. And what about the caller's question about, you know, we're going to be talking about the Capitol occupation for years to come and romanticizing it. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Let me turn you on. I'm sorry. There you go.
Well, I think it's certainly a danger. The caller is right. To me, what inoculates those tendencies towards romanticization is to really bring into that discussion about these different episodes, whether you're talking about Seattle in 99 or the Capitol occupation here, is the place specificity. These things happen in specific places and spaces. And getting into the details of what those places and spaces are and were like is very important. I remember after Seattle, a lot of activists, when I had discussions with them, were like, you know, I couldn't believe that they even tried to have this WTO thing in Seattle. It was like giving us home turf advantage, right? Because you had all the Northwest, the constellation of Northwest radical groups there, as well as all of the visitors. And there is something to be said for why this happened and how it happened here, based on the specific characteristics of not just the city, but downtown Madison, and the fact that there is a three-quarter long stretch of pavement that leads from the university to the Capitol, in which private automobiles are the lowest priority. And every other kind of public expression and public mobility is channeled through. And that allowed for some really interesting kinds of creation of spectacle and mass action. But I'll stop there and hand it over.
Right. And actually, that's a whole nother section that we really should talk about at some point, is the art of protest, which has been documented in a bunch of other books and photo exhibits around Madison, and definitely worth a whole nother program. But we are just fast running out of time, and I want to go back to editor Erica Sagrins, who's joining us along with our other guests, Sarah Van Gelder and Mike Elk and Dan Wong here in the studio. We're talking about the book We Are Wisconsin, The Wisconsin Uprising in the Words of Activist Writers and Everyday Wisconsinites Who Made It Happen. WeAreWisconsinBook.com on the web if you want to download a PDF version, or if you want to purchase a copy. It's going to be in local bookstores soon if it's not there already. I know the mail didn't come today, so probably tomorrow. But anyway, Erica Sagrins, sort of to kind of pull us together here at the end, why this book and where do we go from here with this story?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as we've kind of talked about this hour, there, as the caller talks about, there's definitely the danger of sort of, you know, focusing on this one moment and that, you know, those few weeks this winter. But I think really my take is just that it has really inspired so much, and it's important to continue talking about, but, you know, not for the sake of just talking about it, but, you know, seeing what it's inspired. I mean, among, you know, the unions and the workers that Mike, you know, said that he's been seeing as he goes around the country, but also these other efforts. Like what Sarah talked about with U.S. Uncut and with Rebuild the Dream, I think it's just an exciting moment. And also, I mean, spent a bunch of time, too, in Milwaukee and Madison around the recalls in August. And for me, it was just an exciting moment, you know, even though ultimately the outcome was not what we had hoped. It was exciting for me to just see so many different groups really focused on that and organizing to that goal, you know, even though obviously most recognize that it's not just going to be electoral. I think there was a real synergy there between groups on the left who, you know, would be fighting the next day and maybe, you know, disagreeing with each other the day before, but had that sort of common purpose. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an exciting moment, and I think that now is kind of the time that these discussions